touched nothing, and for a Hollum's sake it's invisible. Gavin drafted a hollow, superviolet egg, the size of his hand. He winced for an instant as if something was paining him. The trick with Yellow Liv is to understand how it releases its power. So, into the middle of this egg, draft liquid yellow. He did. The important bit is to leave absolutely no air inside the container. It has to be solid. He closed it, while looking at the girls, not paying attention. He'd just left an air bubble in the egg. He hadn't noticed. If it's solid, totally airtight, then even if you shake it... Liv raised her hand, opened her mouth, but she was too slow. Gavin shook the egg. It exploded with a blinding flash. Everyone hit the ground. Before Liv even opened her eyes, she heard Gavin laughing. Was he insane? She looked up, but his hair wasn't even ruffled. Now, Gavin said, if that egg had been made of blue Luxin, when it shattered we'd all have been cut to pieces. But as you all know in your heads, if not in your hearts or your bodies apparently, sealed superviolet frays easily. Not that it can't be useful. With a speed and facility that stunned Liv, he drafted another egg and filled it with liquid yellow Luxin. Get up, he told the class. Anna was crying quietly. She'd scraped her knee when she'd fallen, and it was bleeding. Served her right for wearing such a short skirt. The rest of the girls got up, righted their chairs, and sat. Anna stayed on the ground. Get up, Gavin ordered her. You're going to be a drafter in a few months. You want to act like a woman. You're not even ready to act like an adult. The lash of his words hit Anna hard, but every girl in the class felt the sting. His statement was as true for Liv as it was for Anna. She looked away from Anna, realizing how easy it would have been to be in her place right now. She felt a momentary twinge of compassion for the girl, then irritation that she was feeling that. Anna had made her life miserable. Gavin promptly ignored Anna. He flung a strand of superviolet skyward. It was so light, it was caught in the wind and drifted to the west, off the tower. But as long as he held the Luxin open and supported it, and drafted more and more into it, he could send it higher. And he did, rapidly. Then he brought the yellow egg up to the thread of Luxin, made loops to hold it onto the line, and then launched it into the air. His right hand snapped down with the recoil of the launch. The egg zipped along the invisible line, curving out over the tower. At its apex, 200 feet out, it exploded with a sharp report. Far below, Liv heard people in the yard crying out in wonder and surprise. Now, imagine I pointed that at a charging line of horses. It won't kill anyone directly, but horses don't like having things explode in their faces any more than prissy girls do. Blanching and blushing filled the sudden, pained silence. There's a couple of other special ways you can use superviolet in dual-color drafting. Anyone? Gavin asked. Anna lifted her hand uncertainly. He nodded.
For distance control?
That's right. You have to leave your superviolet open, and the longer you make the line, the harder it is to control. It's like juggling when you can't see the balls. But, he held out his hands. A swirl of colours went through his eyes, and he was holding a red ball, a yellow ball, a green ball, a blue ball, and an orange ball. Liv saw him wince again, as if he had a pulled muscle in his back. Then he started juggling. The girls, all of them, even Magister Goldthorn, gasped. First, because the properties of the balls weren't right. Orange was slick, oily. Red was sticky. Yellow was liquid. Then, of course, because it was a different kind of impressive to see someone juggle 5 of anything. Oh, Liv got it. Every ball had a very thin blue Luxin shell, filled with Luxin of a different colour. Gavin closed his eyes and kept juggling. Impossible. Was he just showing off? No, he was showing off, but he was also still teaching. Ah, Liv said, pleased. Someone got it, Gavin said, opening his eyes. With my eyes closed, how am I juggling?
You're the prism. You can do anything, someone mumbled.
Thank you. My butt hasn't been kissed all day, but no.
Did he just say that? You're not juggling, Liv said, recovering first.
Gavin took his hands away from the twirling balls. They kept going in the same intricate pattern. Everyone tightened their eyes and saw the superviolet Luxin connected in a track through the balls. The balls were simply following the invisible track. That's right. If you give a visible reason, even if it's astounding, you can hide an invisible phenomenon right under people's noses. That is the power of superviolet Luxin. Tell you what, Oliviana, will you do me a favor?
Sure.
He smiled. Good. I'll hold you to that. He turned. There was a dark stain on the back of his shirt. Was that blood? Should Liv say something? Magister Goldthorn, I'm sorry, but I have to leave. I still owe you half a class, and I'll make it up to you. In the meantime, if you'd notify the appropriate officials, Oliviana Danovis is hereby recognized as a superviolet yellow bichrome. Her instruction will begin immediately. I would be disappointed if she were outfitted in a style less decent than the average Hrothgari bichromes. Costs should be taken from Chromaria finances. If anyone has a problem with that, direct them to me. Liv forgot about Gavin's shirt instantly. She couldn't believe what she'd just heard. With a few sentences, the prism had changed everything. Freed her. A bichrome. In a word, she'd gone from a life writing letters for some backwater noble to a life of only Orholm knew what. She thought she was imagining it until she saw the exact same stunned expression on Magister Goldthorn's face. It was real. The second part of what he'd said took only a moment more to sink in. Liv was to be kept in a style equivalent to a Hrothgari bichrome at the Chromaria's expense. And the Hrothgari kept their drafters in more lavish apartments than anyone. It was all part of their strategy to attract the best talent. If Liv played it halfway right, she could escape that hellstone harpy, Aglaia Crassos. Gavin smiled at her, a roguish, boyish joy mixing with something deeper Liv couldn't read. Then he left. But watching him jog down the steps out of view, Liv was filled with a vague unease. She'd gotten everything she hoped today, and everything that she hadn't quite dared to hope. But something more had happened. The prism had just bought her. She didn't know why she was worth it, but it didn't strike her as a random gesture. She looked at Vina, who shrugged back, eyes wide. Gavin Guile had some purpose in mind for Liv, and she would perform it gladly. How could she not? But what was it? Chapter 39 The cell's blue was trying to sink into his brain, make him passionless, logical. No room for hatred, for envy, for fury. The dead man was muttering in his wall. Dazen stood and walked over to him. The dead man resided in a particularly shiny section of the Blue Luxin Wall. He was, of course, Dazen's twin. The time has come, the dead man said. You need to kill yourself. The dead man liked to drop a fire in Dazen's lap and see what he did with it. Dazen popped his neck left and right. The dead man popped his neck right and left. What do you mean? Dazen asked. You haven't been willing to do what you need to do. Unless you can cut deeper than Dazen, you— I am Dazen now, Dazen snapped. The man in the wall smiled indulgently. Not yet, you're not. You're still me. You're still Gavin Guile, the brother who lost. Dazen stole your life, but you haven't taken his. Not yet. You're not ready. Talk to me again in another year or two. You're dead, Dazen snapped. You're the dead man, not me. I am Dazen. But his reflection said nothing. His son was out there. His son, not the real Dazen's. The real Dazen was stealing his son, just like he'd stolen his entire life. Gavin had decided long ago that if Dazen was going to steal his life, he would steal Dazen's in return. His younger brother had always been the smarter of the two, so the only way to escape would be to become Dazen, to outthink his brother, to dig a pace below the real Dazen's deepest trap and spring it back on him. So far it hadn't worked. It hasn't worked because you're not willing to risk everything to win.
That was Dazen's genius, the dead man said. You remember the last time you two fought?
When he imprisoned me and stole my life?
No, the last time you fought with your fists.
Gavin couldn't ever forget it.
He'd been the older brother. He needed to win.
He couldn't even remember what they'd fought over. That hadn't been important. He'd probably started it. Dazen had been getting too big for his boots for a while, not giving Gavin the respect he deserved, so Gavin had punched him in the shoulder and called him something foul. Though Gavin was older, Dazen had grown to be at least his size, if not bigger. Most days Dazen would take the abuse with a complaint and a curse, not that day. Dazen had attacked him, and suddenly Gavin had been struck with the fear that had been sneaking up on him for quite some time. What had he lost? They were struggling, trying to throw each other, raining punches to each other's arms, stomach, shoulders. Many were blocked, but even those that got through were more painful than damaging. Fighting your brother had rules. You didn't try to break bones, you didn't hit in the face. It was about submission and dominance and punishment. But if Dazen won one fight, things would never be the same between them. That couldn't happen. In his fear and desperation, Gavin punched Dazen in the face. It rocked Dazen back on his heels, but more from shock than from the power of the blow. Dazen was usually pretty even-keeled, but as soon as Gavin saw his face, he knew he'd made a mistake. A big one. The pain didn't matter, the dominance didn't matter, not to Dazen. He'd gone absolutely crazy. He didn't even need to draft red to utterly lose it, and lose it he did. Dazen bawled into Gavin and swept him off his feet. Gavin tried to pull away, dance aside, pull loose, but Dazen wasn't jockeying for position, he was taking Gavin down. They fell. Gavin landed on top of Dazen, connecting a good shot with his knee. It didn't matter. It was like Dazen didn't even feel it. He just absorbed the shot and pulled Gavin with the force of his fall. Abruptly, Gavin's little brother was on top of him. Dazen grabbed his throat in both hands and squeezed. Gavin's panic receded. They'd both been taught, grappling. He slugged Dazen across the jaw. Nothing. Dazen took it. The next punch Dazen deflected with an elbow. He squeezed. The panic came back with a vengeance. Dazen was going to kill him. Gavin punched and punched and punched, but Dazen just took the punishment. Go ahead, hurt me, but I'm going to kill you. The world was going dark when Dazen abruptly released Gavin. He staggered to his feet as Gavin coughed himself back to life. By the time Gavin stood, his little brother was gone. After that, they hadn't fought again. It was enough. They'd known without saying a word that if they ever fought again, someone would likely get killed. And if I'd won at Sundered Rock, someone would have been. But Dazen had let him live. It was like that moment when he'd had Gavin's throat in his hands. He could have crushed me. He could have killed me, but he let me live instead. Because he was weak.
If Dazen's weak, the dead man said, what does that make you? You lost to him.
He laughed.
Never again. It's taken me this long, but I understand at last. I will take this lesson from my brother. Win at any cost. Be ready to pay it all, and you won't have to.
That was it. Simple.
Now,
Gavin was ready to become Dazen. He would take Dazen's strengths and leave his weaknesses. He reached out a hand and touched his reflection.
You really are a dead man now, he said.
His previous attempts to draft Sub-Red had failed because he couldn't get enough heat. The only thing that generated heat down here was his own body, and he'd nearly killed himself last time when he'd taken too much heat. He'd gone delusional, and still it hadn't been enough. He hadn't been willing to risk everything. He hadn't been willing to die if it took that. He was willing now.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, son, he said aloud.
He drafted a blade of blue luxon. It only held an edge if he concentrated hard, but over a course of days, he and the dead man shaved his long hair off. He would cut off a hank, separate the strands into narrow sheaves, and tie the ends of those so they wouldn't fall apart. When he had a good pile, Smearing as much oil from his body on his makeshift yarn as he could, he began weaving. This had to be done first. Later he wouldn't be in any shape to try it. For once, the blue helped him. The old him, back when he was free, back when he was Gavin, could never have done this. Threading the hairs over, under, over, under, making mistakes, starting over, fumbling and dropping the whole unfinished thing, trying to catch it and losing a week's work in 1 second when his fingers pulled the threads loose, it all would have driven him mad. But Blue reveled in detail, in putting every hair in its place. Dazen didn't even notice it at first, but one day he realized he had something he'd lost long, long ago. He had hope. He would get out. He knew that now. It was only a matter of time. Vengeance was coming, and, if long delayed, it would be all the sweeter for it. Dazen sighed, contented, and continued his work. Chapter 40 Gavin tore off the stained shirt and grunted as he scraped the cloth across his burn. 50 dinar shirt, and I ruined it in half an hour. Worse, he'd noticed some of the girls glancing at the spreading stain. That wasn't a disaster. They wouldn't ask about it. One of the Spectrum would. He liked to save up his lies for them. He cursed under his breath. Gavin knew that Mauricia must have some sort of an organizational scheme to how she put away his clothing, but whatever it was, he'd never pierced its logic. He rifled through stacks of shirts and pants and breeches and cloaks and abiyas and robes and thobes and pethasoi and gotras, most of which he didn't think he'd ever worn. Or Hollum, he had a lot of clothes, and these were only his summer clothes. He supposed it was because, as Prism, he was supposed to be of all peoples. So if he met with an ambassador or needed to suddenly visit a Bornea, he would already have local clothing that fit him. He was still standing, bare-chested, ointment smeared on his burn. At least he had the sense to keep aid supplies in his own room when the door opened. Mauricia slipped in quietly. She glanced at the burn on his ribs. Her jade-green eyes lit with anger, though Gavin couldn't tell if it was at him or for him. Maybe a bit of both. She grabbed the ointment from his table and smeared more around to his back. Ouch. Apparently he'd missed some spots. Then she bandaged him with a practiced hand. She wasn't gentle.
"Does my lord need assistance finding another shirt?" she asked.
"Ow!" he yelped. He cleared his throat, lowered his voice an octave. "Please." She went to a stack he swore he'd searched thoroughly and immediately plucked a shirt from its depths. He didn't think he'd ever worn it before, but it was a style he liked, and dark enough that if the ointment soaked through this one, no one would notice. Mauricia had a certain magic of her own. He could swear that shirt hadn't been there before. She began whistling quietly as she dressed him and fixed his hair. It was an old tune. Pretty. Mauricia was a good whistler. Oh, the tune was Little Lamb Lost. A comment on not being able to find his own clothes? Probably. He had bigger things to worry about. He'd dealt with his brother. How much trouble could the Spectrum be? "I'll be leaving either in the morning or the next day," Gavin said. "There's a young man testing downstairs. Kip. He's my, natural son." There was no need to use the nephew euphemism with Mauricia. Mauricia knew that Gavin had imprisoned his brother, but even she didn't know that Gavin wasn't Gavin. She hadn't known either of them before the war, so she didn't need to know. He trusted her completely, but the fewer people who knew that secret, the longer it would be before all this crashed down on his head. "He's 15, I mean. Will you find appropriate clothes for him and pack for both of us for 2 weeks?"
"More for fighting or for impressing?"
"Both."
"Of course," she said flatly.
On his way out the door, Gavin grabbed his sword in its jeweled scabbard. It wasn't nearly the hand with a blade that even the least of the Blackguard was. He had been quite skilled once, but once he'd realized he could draft any combination of color and instantly have a weapon of whatever kind he needed, he hadn't practiced with plain steel as often as was required to compete with professional warriors like the Blackguard. Of course, that assumed a fair fight, and there was no such thing with a drafter. The blackguards themselves would fight with whatever was at hand, blades, magic, a goblet of wine, or a face full of sand. He tucked the Elysian pistols into his belt too, just to be an ass. When Gavin stepped out of his door, there were two blackguards waiting for him. His escort. It was his compromise with the white. He got to travel without the blackguard when he thought it was absolutely necessary, so most of the time, as long as he agreed to have them around when he was in a place where assassination was more likely. The white wasn't pleased with how he'd interpreted their agreement, but he clung ferociously to what little freedom he had. He strode quickly through the single hall that separated the halves of this level. He and the white each had one half of the floor. Because of the Chromeria's rotation, Gavin's half was always pointed toward the sun. An odd irony that the white should be forever in shadow, though in her elder years this white had appreciated it. It minimized the temptations of drafting and hastening her own death. Gavin wondered again how she did it. Without drafting, he would feel empty, weak. Life wouldn't be worth living without chromaturgy. It defined who he was. Surely it had done the same for the white, and yet she lived on, her will still iron, her back unbowed. Stepping past the blackguards guarding her room, he knocked on her door. "She's not here," the man on the left said. "The white has gone to meet with a Chromeria. She thought it would be rude to keep the full spectrum waiting because of one man's tardiness." This was how the blackguards registered their displeasure. His own blackguards knew where he was going as soon as he turned toward the white's room rather than toward the lift, but they didn't tell him. The white's blackguards knew where he was going as soon as they saw him, but they didn't tell him the white was gone until he knocked, causing him to waste more time and be even later. One man's tardiness? What's the spectrum going to talk about without me? I called the meeting. As was typical, the blackguards were careful in showing their irritation. There would be no more trouble from them for a while. Iron Fist would see to that. If they peeved Gavin more than occasionally, he would do more to avoid them, and they wouldn't be able to do their job of protecting him. Still, they wanted him to respect them, which he did, after a fashion. It's an odd person who volunteers to jump in front of an arrow when they don't even know if they'll like the prism or white that they'll be assigned to guard. But he wouldn't be chained. Power was freedom. Power had to be maintained. "If you can't serve me well," Gavin said to his own two blackguards, "you can't serve me at all." He turned on his heel and started walking toward the lift. Of course they said nothing. They simply accompanied him on his left and right. Commander Iron Fist trained them to ignore orders that put their charges in danger. Gavin waved his arms down, drafting bars of blue Luxim strengthened with yellow down to his left and right. His blackguards hesitated momentarily as he kept walking briskly, and he closed the gap in the middle. He kept walking, not even looking back, as he threw up walls of solid blue, red, green, yellow, and superviolet. It satisfied a small part of him. His brother really had gotten under his skin. The bastard. But at the same time, this was necessary. The blackguard had to know they couldn't control him. That was how smart bodyguards worked. Impede your freedom a little, then a little more, and soon they had their way. Gavin wasn't going to let that happen. If he had the blackguard hovering around him at all times, as they ultimately wished, they would learn not just his secrets like the skimmer and the condor, but his final secret. What would the blackguard do if they found out that Gavin wasn't Gavin at all? They might decide he was the de facto prism, and that was enough. Or they might decide he was a threat to the real prism. Or he might split the blackguard into warring camps. Pleasant thought. A bunch of elite warrior drafters trying to destroy each other. That was what made this necessary. The blackguard must be taught, and taught again, to accept the crumbs Gavin let drop. "You can protect me if you serve me wholeheartedly, and I'll withdraw that privilege when I please, for any reason or none." At first, years ago, Commander Spear had punished those blackguards who let Gavin escape them. When that didn't work, he'd made the punishments public, shaming the blackguards for that which wasn't their fault. Gavin had felt awful, and had not changed a bit. Commander Spear had escalated the punishments, publicly flogging several men, including a young Iron Fist. Gavin had responded by yawning and not letting any blackguards near him for a month. Then he'd walked through crowded markets, leaving bound and gagged the blackguards that Commander Spear sent, and he'd done it in the aftermath of the war, when there had been not a few men who would have gladly killed him. When there finally was an assassination attempt, and no blackguards present, Commander Spear had discharged the six blackguards who were supposed to be protecting Gavin. The White had finally stepped in and discharged Commander Spear instead. Gavin hadn't felt sorry for the man. Once he'd learned that using Gavin's guilt against him wouldn't work, he should have tried something else. A man who couldn't change tactics shouldn't be in charge of the Blackguard in the first place. The move hadn't made Gavin any friends, but it had left him in charge. Besides, he didn't need friends. The two Blackguards at the lift looked at each other as he approached. The woman on the left was short but as thick as a bull. She said, "High Lord Prism, I notice you don't have an escort. May I join you?" Gavin grinned. "Since you ask so nicely," he said. They opened the lift for him, and in moments he was on the next level below his and the White's floor. The blackguards on watch blinked at his sole escort. Doubtless they knew the guard rotation and knew she wasn't supposed to be on prism duty, nor was the prism supposed to be guarded by only one blackguard. "High Lord Prism," one of them said, a tall, red-orange bichrome youth, only 20 years old, thus quite talented. "May I accompany you?" "Thank you, but no," Gavin said. "You can't protect me from what's waiting here." Gavin had told Kip that the White tried to balance the prism's power, but he didn't like it much when she did. He stepped into the council room. The colours were scattered around the table. For formal events, they would sit in order around the table, sub-red, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, super-violet, black, prism, white. For meetings like this one, however, the pull of sitting by friends, or the lure of grabbing one of the more comfortable chairs, outweighed the natural tendency to sit in the same spot every time. Gavin found the last spot, between the super-violet, a tall, skin-and-bones, coal-black Parian woman named Sada, and the soft, lighter-skinned Hrothgari man with the beaded beard, Clytos Blue. Gavin had told Kip that each colour represented a country, and that was mostly true. Each satrap or satrapper appointed one colour. It was the most important decision most rulers ever made, but the system had begun to break down even before the False Prisms War, when Andros Guile had bribed and blackmailed his way into the red seat, though the Blood Forest already had one colour. He'd been so audacious he'd stolen that seat from Hrothgar, claiming that the Giles' sliver of swampland in Hrothgari made him eligible for the Hrothgari seat. Of course, after the war, similar logic had been used to deprive Tyria of a seat. There were so many interlocking and overlapping layers of loyalty it was dizzying. Both the red and the green were Hrothgari, and thus likely to unite on any issue concerning Hrothgar. But the green was also cousins with Giotolva, an Abornian woman who was the yellow. The Abornians strangled both Parian and Hrothgari trade through the Narrows, so anything to do with trade would see them at each other's throats, but on anything else they might try to form a block. The sub-red was a Blood Forester who were allies now with their stronger neighbours, the Hrothgari, but her parents had been killed in the war by the Green's brothers. And on it went. Every noble family in the Seven Satrapies did everything it could to get at least one son or daughter into the Chromeria, if for nothing else than to try to watch their backs. In turn, everyone in the Spectrum did all they could to protect themselves. Family bonds, clan bonds, national bonds, colour bonds, and ideological bonds cut every which way. The colours were political creatures as much as they were magical. To be named a colour took a certain amount of chromaturgical aptitude. The White saw to that. But after that bar was reached, not a few of these seats had found inhabitants at the same time that donkey trains loaded with gold had made their way into royal houses. Gavin knew it had been thus when his own father had joined. The White, in her wheeled chair, said, "I call this meeting to order. Let the record show that all colours except for red are in attendance." They hated that. Hated that they couldn't get rid of Andros Guile. They hated that in defiance of all convention, He hadn't attended a meeting in 5 years, but still insisted that his votes be counted. They hated what his having his vote delivered by messenger said about how little he valued their opinions. No eloquence would ever move Andros Gyle. He would see and weigh every issue alone, and decide, regardless of the mummery of these spectrum meetings. But they feared him, too. The White said, "Lord Prism, you have called this meeting, so I turn over the proceeding to you." She thought she was thwarting him, that he'd grown too independent, that he might become dangerous if she didn't yank the leash. Careful, Aurea. When choked, dogs go docile, but wolves go wild. Gavin's relationship with the Spectrum had always been thorny. Of course, when he'd been recuperating after Sundered Rock, they'd stripped him of his title of Promarchus, taking control of the armies away from him, as custom dictated, but they also hadn't known whether he would allow it. Still learning his new guise, he had, but he didn't care much for any of the colours, personally. Nor did they care for him. He'd lived too long, become too powerful. He didn't need them, and that scared them. They hated his father. They hated the Gyles, and they stymied Gavin whenever they could. Patience, Gavin. Plenty of time for Purpose 6. Plenty of room to maneuver. You are Andros Gyle's son. We need to release the city of Garriston immediately. Pull out all of our men and give it back to King Haradul, Gavin said, preferably with an apology that we didn't do it sooner. Silence. Followed by awkward silence. Clytos Blue chuckled uncertainly. When no one else joined him, he fell silent. King? The White asked. That's what he's calling himself. Gavin didn't elaborate. Sada Superviolet said, "Surely you're not serious, Lord Prism. The governorship transfers to Perea in a few weeks. It's our right. People have made plans. Ships are sailing already. If we must have this conversation, let us have it in 2 years from now."
"Absolutely not," Delara Orange said. She was a 40-year-old bichrome with great sagging breasts and the red and orange in her eyes pushing to the very edge of her irises. She was an Atashian. Atash got the governorship right after Perea's. "Perea took the very first rotation when there were actually a few treasures left in the city, and you looted it all."
"We also had to repair a city that had been burned to the ground and care for its injured and ill. We took only what was appropriate recompense."
"Stop," Gavin said, before it could go any further. "You're having the wrong fight. This isn't about who has the governorship, in what order, or for how long. It's been 16 years since we crushed Tyria. They still don't have a representative in this room. There are fewer Tyrians in the Chromaria every year. Why is that? Have they suddenly stopped bearing drafters there? Or is it because we have demanded a tribute from them so ruinous they can't support their drafters, which in turn impoverishes their land further? Then we hold Garriston, their main port and their largest city, and your governors tax every orange and pomegranate and melon. I've been to Garriston, and it's a shadow of its former greatness. The great irrigation canals are full of sand. The fields are worked by women and children, or no one, and there's not a drafter to be found."
"You pity them?" Delara Orange asked. "When my brothers rise from the dead and the castle of Rue is rebuilt, I'll feel pity for Garriston. They joined Daeson. It was their war that killed tens of thousands. I saw them cast Sir Trapper Nahid's 2-year-old son down the great steps. I saw them cut open her pregnant belly, take her babe, and make bets on how far down the steps one of their men could throw the screaming child. They cut off the satrapper's nose and ears and breast and arms and legs and threw her down after, while we watched. The babe made it all the way to the last step, in case you're curious. I got some of its brains on my dress. I wanted to try to catch it, but they didn't move. No one did. Those are the people you wish us to have mercy on. Or maybe it's the people who sank the entire refugee flotilla, which had not a single drafter or armed man on board."
That was Gavin's fault, as Daeson. He sent a young, new general, Gad Delmata, who had always been efficient and direct. Gavin had told Gad to secure Rue. General Delmata had taken that to mean to secure it so there could never be any resistance ever again. He'd exterminated the royal family, all 56 members of it, and scores of their male retainers, publicly, one at a time, in the order of their succession, and burned down their great castle, the pride of Attache. When the people had fled, General Del Mata had sent fire drafters after the flotilla. Gavin had only found out about it afterward. And then what could he do? It was war, and his general had followed his orders. And when General Del Mata marched on the great city of Eidos next, it had surrendered without a fight because of their fear of the man, because of his cruelty. "Maybe," Gavin said, "we could count how many children died when you burned Garriston in retaliation and barred the gates so no one could escape." I seem to recall that all the Tyrian drafters and all but 200 of the Tyrian soldiers were 100 leagues away at the time. How long did it take for the river to clear of bodies? So many little corpses bobbing in the water. Even with all those hundreds of sharks turning the bay to bloody foam with their thrashing, it was weeks, wasn't it? Gavin had never learned whose idea it was, but when Garriston had been burned, someone had stationed red drafters all around the walls. Soldiers shielded the drafters while they hurled Red Luxin back and forth in swathes throughout the city. Red Luxin was used as fuel for lamps. Spread throughout a city, it had made a hell for the residents of Garriston. Tens of thousands had jumped into the river, and thousands more had jumped in on top of them. Their bodies themselves had almost been enough to dam the river in places, and then some of his older brothers, cleverer drafters, had floated Red Luxin down the river in little boats of green or blue Luxin, or mixed red and orange Luxin to make a concoction so flammable it would burn even under water, or mixed it with superviolet to make it float, burning on the very water itself. Between the fire, the smoke, the water, the press of the crowds, the crushing deaths as whole buildings fell into the packed river, and the fire floating down the river itself, there had been death on a scale no one had imagined before. Before the war, Garriston had been home to more than 100,000 people. His own conscriptions had thinned that to perhaps 80,000. After the fires, only 10,000 remained. And after the first winter, only 5,000.
"Enough," the black said.
Carver was no drafter, and so in some respects he was the weakest member of the spectrum. As the black, he was responsible for most of the mundane aspects of ruling Little Jasper, importing food, managing trade, awarding contracts, recruiting and paying soldiers, maintenance for buildings and the docks, building ships and everything else that the white ceded to his control so she could focus on managing the Chromeria itself. But he was a formidable man, and Gavin respected him.
"We could list horrors all day, Lord Prism. What's the point?"
"The point is, out of my 5 great purposes left, the only purely altruistic one is to free Garriston. Those people are suffering because of me, and you bastards have stopped every attempt I've made to help them." "The point is," Gavin said, "that the Tyrians have as much reason to hate us as we have to hate them. We've been punishing them for the war for 16 years. Most of the people paying the price now were children when the war started. They see no reason they should continue paying for what their dead fathers did or didn't do. They hate us, and the fact is, none of us, none of the 7 satrapies, want to go back there with an army."
"What are you saying?" Luxlord Black asked. "Do you have specific intelligence of a threat?"
"I'm saying if we don't pull out of Garriston and end the tribute on our terms, King Haradul is going to take Garriston by force and end it on his." That's what King Haradul had meant when he told Gavin, "We're going to take back what you stole from us." But Gavin couldn't tell them about that without revealing more secrets, and they wouldn't believe it anyway.
"I'm failing to see the humour here," Clytos Blue said nervously. He was a coward in a dozen ways, but Hrothgar wasn't going to give up Garriston easily, Gavin knew. "We've got 1,000 soldiers and 50 drafters there. The drafters alone could hold off whatever army this King Haradul could raise."
"Knuckling under to a rebel, a man who declares himself a king. It's unthinkable," the orange said. "He deserves death." "Oh, father, it's too bad you never come anymore. You would enjoy this. I can do one thing that you never could."
"First," Gavin said, "us leaving is the right thing to do. We're punishing people who have suffered too much already, and they hate us for it. We've been planting the seeds of another war for the last 16 years.
They started the war, yes. General Del Mata was born in Garriston, yes. But that doesn't excuse us from what we've done, which is not just wrong, but also stupid.
Excuse me? Delara Orange said.
Her predecessor to the Orange, her mother, had been the architect of the rotating occupation scheme.
You heard me, Gavin said. We get almost no Tyrian drafters. You think that's because none are born there anymore?
Ha! What if, instead of training here, where they are poor and reviled and suspected as traitors, what if someone decided to train them closer to home? A new school, a Chromaria dedicated to vengeance, started because of our pettiness and stupidity.
Nonsense, Delara said.
We would have heard of such a thing.
But what if you hadn't? Gavin asked. The quality of instruction might not be as good as ours. I hope it wouldn't be. But even with a few rudimentary fire spells, how long could your 50 drafters stationed in Garriston hold out against several hundred? How long could your soldiers hold out against thousands of rebels who could hide in plain sight among the locals? The fact is, King Haridul will take Garriston. He will demand it on terms that he knows are insufferable, and then he will seize it. The only question is, will we lose and lose face and make King Haridul seem like a winner and finally get drawn into a war your satrapies don't have the stomach for, or will we forego a tribute which, after it's divided 6 ways, is insignificant and give away that which we can't keep? If we give Garrison to King Haridul before he even asks, we look magnanimous. If we give him an apology, we look moral. And if we do both before he asks, we deprive him of a victory and a cause.
"Do you have evidence of all this?"
Delara asked. She was slippery, as Orange's tended to be. But drafting Red Luxon made a drafter more aggressive and reckless over time, too.
"Because it seems to me that you would like us to give away an entire city for little reason, otherwise. We don't know this new King Haridul. He has only recently taken power. He hasn't sent us a single emissary, much less made demands."
"You're telling me none of you have spies at Haridul's side?" Gavin shot back. A few sardonic smiles and silence. No one was going to admit that, of course. They didn't trust each other enough. There had been no wars in the last 16 years, but that didn't mean that everyone's interests were aligned. The Chromaria and every capital was as full of spies as it had ever been.
"If you don't," Gavin said, in an imperious tone sure to needle them, "get some."
"High Lux, Lord, we take your advice to the satrapies very seriously, of course," Clytos Blue started to say.
The Hrothgari hated Gavin, and had since he'd ended the war with the Blood Forest. Gavin cut him off. "Time to play the hothead."
"Listen, you morons. I don't know how you didn't see this coming. Or maybe some of you did. Your loyalty is noted. The fact remains this is rebellion, and it's heresy. King Haridul is talking about overthrowing the satrapies and the worship of Orholm himself. I would have thought Orholm would command better service from his colours."
"Enough! Enough, Lord Prism!" the White barked.
She looked at Gavin like she couldn't believe what he'd said. Nothing like calling powerful men and women idiots, ingrates, disloyal and impious all at once. Looking around the room, Gavin saw shock on some faces and hatred on others. In the silence, Clytos Blue spoke first. He was a Blue. It was only natural he should think things through faster than anyone else.
"I believe that we should take the Lord Prism seriously. It's only prudent that we serve the satrapies and Orholm as zealously as he does every day."
The words were delivered straight, but the malice couldn't have been more evident.
"I move that we send a delegation to Garriston to assess the threat from the alleged rebel Haridul and report back to us directly."
"A delegation? Are you blind, or stupid, or corrupt?" Gavin demanded.
"By the time that Gavin," the White said, "enough!"
She took the vote for a delegation to be sent and report back in 2 months' time. It passed, 5-0, with 2 abstentions. Gavin sat back in his chair, as if stunned, defeated. In the silence, before anyone stood to leave, he shook his head. Said grimly, "I ceded power after the war, gave up the Promachia. I became an advisor when many wanted me to be an emperor in truth. and now you ignore me.
Very well. But tell your satraps and satrappers this. Prepare for war. King Haradul won't stop at taking Garriston. I guarantee it.
You see, Father, this is the one thing I can do that you never could. I can handle appearing to lose.
Chapter 41 Liv had barely seen her new apartments in the Yellow Tower before she'd gone out. Not to celebrate, not because she was impulsive, but because her courage had been fading with every passing second. She'd been to half the moneylenders on the islands before she found one willing to do business with her. Stepping inside her new room, she found that the tower's slaves had brought all her meagre belongings over from the closet she'd called home for the last 3 years, and there was a woman sitting on her bed.
"Salve, Liv. Been out celebrating?" Aglaia Krassos asked.
"What are you doing in my apartments?" Liv asked. "How'd you get in here?"
"It's not good to forget your friends, Oliviana."
Aglaia stood and came to stand a hand's breadth from Liv's face.
"What? You're here to threaten me? I'm shaking."
Something ugly crossed Aglaia's face, but then was replaced by that smooth mask again and that disingenuous laugh.
"Careful with that sharp tongue, girl. You may cut your own throat." "I'm done," Liv said. "Gavin Guile has bought you to be his bed slave, I heard."
"Go to hell," Liv said.
"You're the one who'll do that. Seeing how you're throwing yourself at the man who murdered your mother and destroyed your country."
It was a tremendous slap. Liv took a step back. Aglaia had made a reference to the burning of Garriston before, but Liv had never heard anything remotely like that. In truth, Liv had no idea, but considering the source, she was willing to bet it was a lie.
"The prison didn't have anything to do with that. And you know that because he said so? Your mother died in those fires. Your father led the fight against Gavin Guile." "What do you care about Garriston? Hrothgar fought on the prism's side. Your father fought beside Gavin."
"And my brother is the governor of Garriston, so I'm in a position to know things," Aglaia said.
She lowered her voice and leaned in.
"And maybe now you are too."
So that was what this was about.
"No," Liv said. "I'm finished with you, with Hrothgar, and with your lies."
Fealty to one. That was the Danavis motto, with strong suggestion that it was fealty only to one. And Liv wasn't about to serve this one.
"Welcome to your new life, Liv. You're important now. You are a player in the great game, and your hand isn't all bad. You see, Liv, you might be Tyrian, but no one's going to hold that against you any more. It will only make you more remarkable for overcoming such a handicap. The good life can be yours."
"You can't buy me," Liv said.
"We already did.
Things are different now, by the prism's own command."
Aglaia's eyebrows rose, slowly making her horsey face seem even longer. It was a practiced gesture, but then nothing about her was genuine.
"I've been working with you for, what, 3 years now? And I went back through my notes. I never thought you were a thief, Oliviana Danavis, but now you're abandoning your duty after 3 years of schooling. 3 years we've supported your every need."
"Oh, so generously, too," Liv said.
"If it had been more generous, your debt would be that much greater now. Here's my question, Liv. What kind of woman are you?"
It was the same question that had put a quill in Liv's hand to sign away a fortune. With her new friendship with Gavin, she could probably tell the Hrothgari to go bugger themselves. What could they say against the Prism's decision? And though Liv had gone from a nothing, a monochrome talented in a minimally useful colour, to a bichrome, she still wasn't worth fighting over. Plenty of each nation's investments went bad. Drafters died, or burned out, or switched loyalty in the last year of their training. Every nation tried to steal drafters, and the Hrothgari were more successful at it than anyone else, so surely they wouldn't fight too hard to keep Liv. But to be a Danavis was to act with honour. Always.
"What do you want?" Liv asked.
"You've been an embarrassment to me, Liv. The hardly talented daughter of a rebel general, and now you're going to be a jewel in my crown. You will be my vengeance on those who thought to slight me.
and for that, I need you to be a success. You'll already be collecting a generous allowance from the bursar out of the Chromaria's general fund. Keep that, and we'll pay you double as well. We'll forgive your debt and the years of service you already owe us. Hell, if you play your cards right, you can draw allowances from 3 or 4 nations before you leave the Jaspers. Indeed, you won't need to leave the Chromaria at all if you serve us well. Think about that. You can have a life here, at the center of the world, where everything important happens. Bed who you want, marry who you want, give your children every advantage you were denied. Or you can go serve some lordling somewhere, writing letters and examining his wife's bed to see if she's faithful to him, hoping he'll give you permission to marry someone you can tolerate. Out of all the nations, Hrothgar is the best to serve, and the worst to offend.
But why do you want me to spy on the prison? He's never done anything to offend Hrothgar.
We like to keep an eye on our friends. It helps us remain friends.
And yet you were just telling me how I could do this to hurt the man who killed my mother. Which is it, Aglaia? Do you want me to betray him to hurt him? Or it's not really a betrayal at all because you aren't going to hurt him?
Well said, Aglaia said. But then she continued, unflappable. The point is, you may be able to damage the man personally, who is responsible for so much havoc in your country, but your interference, your betrayal, perverse girl insisting on calling the service of your own country a betrayal, your betrayal won't result in war. These lands have seen enough of that.
It took Liv a moment to digest.
It did make sense, in a way.
But this is impossible. I don't know the prison. He's talked to me once.
Once. And he liked you.
I don't know that I go that far.
Do you have any idea how hard it is to get someone next to that man? We're going to give you all this just for trying. Besides, we know he has a weakness for Tyrians.
A tiny, quick lift of her eyebrows showed that she was honestly surprised that the prison would have such bad taste.
Maybe you can use this son of his to get close to him. We don't care.
It was bad enough to be asked to betray the prison, but to use Kip to get to him? No, Kip was a good boy. Liv wouldn't do it. There was only one way out of this, and she'd known it all along. Liv pulled out 3 coin sticks.
This is how much the Hrothgari government has spent on my upkeep for the last 3 years, with interest. Here, take it. I'm done with you. I'm free. I don't owe you anything.
Aglaia Krassos didn't even look at the coins. She didn't ask how Liv had gotten so much money. In truth, it had taken signing over a writ to an Arbornean moneylender that would allow him to receive her allowance directly, and a ruinous interest rate. Liv was a pauper once more. She'd have to sell some of the marvellous dresses they'd given her just to stay afloat.
Liv, Liv, Liv. I don't want to be your enemy. But now that you're finally worth something, I'd swive a horse before I let you go. You have a cousin who was here when you first arrived, showed you how things work here, yes?
Erythana, Liv said.
She's a green serving Count Knassos in Western Hrothgar. She just petitioned to marry some blacksmith. The Count has put a hold on it. At my request.
You, Liv said, trembling.
Lovely couple, apparently, so happy together. Tragic if the Count decided the land needed Erythana to marry another drafter to increase her odds of having gifted children. Go to hell. And your own studies can be opposed. And rumours can be started from dozens of corners about all sorts of despicable things you've done. We can poison any well when you finish your studies and are looking for work. You can't stay under the prism's patronage forever. The second his eyes turn elsewhere.
I'm not worth that much to Hrothgar.
Liv said, real fear constricting her throat.
No, not to Hrothgar. But to me you are. Your attitude has made you worth my full attention. And if you make me look bad, I will make you mourn the day you ever met me.
I already do.
Liv felt deflated.
Get out. Get out before I kill you with my bare hands.
Aglaia stood, grabbed the money sticks, and said,
I'll take these for my troubles. After you've reconsidered, you know where to find me. Get out!
Aglaia walked out. Liv was left trembling. Not 30 seconds later there was a knock on the door. That was it. Liv was going to kill her. She strode to the door and threw it open.
It wasn't a glare. A beautiful woman stood there, a blood forester with the oddly pale, freckled skin that still seemed strange to live even after years at the Cromeria, and red hair like a flame. The woman was dressed in a slave's dress, but it was tailored to her lean figure, and a finer cotton than Liv had ever seen any slave wear. A nobleman's slave? The slave handed Liv a note.
"Mistress," she said, "from the High Lord Prism."
Liv Danavis stared at the note, feeling stupid, off balance. It read, "Please come see me at your earliest convenience." Her heart leapt into her throat. A summons from the Prism. So here it was, the beginning of her paying her debt to Gavin Gyle. She didn't fool herself by hoping it would be the end of it, too. When you owed a Lux Lord, you owed them forever. She just hadn't thought he'd ask for her so soon. Oddly, the first thing she thought of was, what do you wear for an audience with the Prism? Liv didn't usually pay much attention to her choice of clothing. Maybe that was because when you only have a few changes of clothes, you wear what's clean and despair of ever wearing what's fashionable. That, of course, had changed instantly. Gavin had ordered that she be kept in an equivalent fashion to a Rathgari bichrome, and that meant lots of clothes, a few jewels, and this huge apartment, literally 5 times larger than the one she'd lived in for the last 3 years. And though she might not have any money, now she had makeup. Now she had options, and she wasn't sure she liked it. The idea of turning into a prissy girl like Anna made Liv's stomach turn. The slave was still standing at the door, waiting to be dismissed, with the pleasant, neutral expression of a woman ignoring the cluelessness of her superior.
"Pardon me, Kaline," Liv said, "but would you help me?"
Liv always felt awkward when it came to dealing with slaves. No one in Recton had been rich enough to afford one, and the few slaves that came through working with the caravans were treated the same as other servants. Things were more formal at the Cromeria, and most of the other students had grown up having slaves, or at least being around them. So Liv always felt like everyone else knew what to do while she was all thumbs. She still felt weird calling a woman 10 years her senior by the diminutive Kaline. Of course, now that Liv was a bichrome, she was going to have to get used to it fast, or she was going to look like an idiot even more often than usual. The slave cocked an eyebrow like any 28-year-old would at any 17-year-old being foolish.
"I don't know what to wear," Liv said in a rush. "I don't even know what 'at your earliest convenience' means. Does that mean actually at my earliest convenience, or does it mean go right this moment, even if I were just wearing a towel?"
"You can take a few minutes to dress appropriately," the slave said. Liv stood paralyzed. Was what she was wearing now appropriate?
"Most women called to the Prism's room wear something more elegant,"
the slave said, eyeing Liv's plain skirt and blouse. Maybe the fitted blue dress, then, or that odd Elysian black silk sheath. But that was more of an evening dress, wasn't it? Or should she wear the shockingly small— Liv wrinkled her nose. There was something about the slave's statement that made her nervous. She could just imagine a procession of beautiful women queued up outside the Prism's door. Liv had never heard any gossip about who the Prism took to his bed, but she wasn't exactly in the middle of the juicy gossip circles, and she could certainly imagine more than a few girls willing to dress or undress any way the Prism wanted. In addition to basically being the center of the universe, he was gorgeous, commanding, witty, smart, young, rich, and unmarried. Whoever had packed her drawers with cosmetics had bought mostly skin lighteners or darkeners, but with Liv's Copian cream-coloured skin, she didn't have a hope of looking as light as a West Atashian. Her eyes were too dark anyway, and with wavy hair, even with a darkener on her skin, she wasn't going to look Parian. There was no hiding that she was Tyrian. All those other girls and women would look fantastic in their fancy dresses and perfect makeup. They'd feel comfortable, beautiful. Liv would feel like a fool and look like a tramp. How many of the women called to the Prism's room had gone with ulterior motives? How many had been acting for one country or another? How many of the ones who hadn't been co-opted had gone with their own agenda anyway? All of them? She wasn't going upstairs to seduce Gavin Gyle. To hell with Aglaia and her ilk, so why should she make herself look like she was?
"To hell with it," Liv said.
She didn't swear much, but it felt good right now. She threw down a dress that probably cost as much as she'd spent all last year.
It's convenient for me to go right now. The slave looked like she wanted to speak, but she stopped herself. This way, ma'am.
After they headed up the Lux Lord's lift, the slave led Liv to the blackguards stationed there. The woman of the pair searched Liv for weapons. Thoroughly. Liv couldn't help but feel a little violated.
They take their job seriously, don't they?
She said, as they finally led her to what Liv assumed was the prism's door.
Do you have any idea what it would mean for the world if the prism died? He's not always an easy man, but he's a much better man than prisms usually are. And there are many of us who would do anything for him. Anything. Remember that, ma'am?
Or Holum's prickly beard. But the slave woman was protective. The slave stopped at the door, knocked three times, and opened it. Liv stepped into the prism's room and found him sitting behind a desk, staring at her. His eyes were entrancing. Right now they looked like diamonds, scattering light everywhere. He gestured to the chair across from him, and Liv sat.
Thank you, Mauricio. You may go, Gavin said to the slave.
Then he turned his diamond eyes on Liv and said, It's time for that favor.
Chapter 42
Scout! Corvin called. She's seen us, son of a bitch!
After Rakten, Corvin and Karis had decided to travel together. Both wanted to go after King Charadul's army, if for different reasons.